Hello there, folks, and welcome to Christ in Every Word, a podcast of the Concordia Bible Institute, housed on the beautiful campus of Concordia University, Wisconsin. This is your opportunity to read, mark, learn, and inwardly digest the sacred scriptures with Dr. John Seleska, Director Emeritus of the Concordia Bible Institute, and me, Dr. Brian Gurman, Assistant Professor of Theology here at the university and the current Director of the Bible Institute. Dr. Seleska has had a long career as a parish pastor, college and seminary professor, and he's known for highlighting how central Christ is throughout the entire Bible. So it's an honor to be with him here in the podcast room and learn a little bit more from him about the book of 2 Samuel, and I believe we're now ready to start chapter 4.
Chapter 4, but again, we need to provide that framework within which to discuss this particular chapter. 4 and 5 today hopefully will give us some insight into David's rule, the beginning of the rule, and how that rule is going to proceed as he becomes more and more powerful in the kingdom. But in chapter 3, you'll recall that there is this divided kingdom that had been established after the death of Saul. And we realize that there was an Israel apart from Judah that already begins to show itself here. It will become more magnified as we go along in the history. But it's divided at this point. David has not taken full control, and that is because of the fact that Saul was made, Saul's son, Ishbosheth, was made king by Abner, who is the, we'll say, de facto ruler, because I think you realize that we talked a little bit about this last time, that Ishbosheth was a kind of feckless, ineffective, weak person, and it was Abner who would be the ruler in fact, although Abner realized that he was not in Saul's line or anything of that nature. Nevertheless, he sort of took control. We have David's house being strengthened, that first verse in chapter 3, and Saul's house weakening. And then we have that incident. We talked a little bit about it. I'll just refer to it here, where Abner took this concubine, Rizpah, one of Saul's, quotes, wives, had sexual relations with her, and Ishbosheth, this feckless guy, questioned him on that. Well, Abner, being in control, being an army man, was a little upset by the fact that this young, quote, squirt should be able to question his behavior. Who do you think you are? Almost as if to say to the king, questioning what I do with this, quote, woman. He didn't even call her by name. It was just a woman, as far as he was concerned, to be used. Well, then he said, that's enough. I'm not going to be ruler, and you're not going to be ruler, so I'm going to go to David and hand the whole kingdom over to him, which in fact then he begins to do. And David says, I'll enter into an agreement, a covenant with you, but first of all, I have to have my wife, Michal, delivered to me. And of course, that is accomplished then, and he takes Michal, and then it, of course, goes into a little bit of the leadership of David under these circumstances. The men of Judah make him king. So he's king over that part of the country. But Israel is still, in a sense, not with him until Abner is the one who will effect this trade, this transition from the house of Saul to the house of David, because Abner himself seems to understand that this was God's will, that God had in fact commanded it to be so, and that he would carry it out. And they entered into an agreement. It was then made sort of official, and Abner is sent on his way in peace from Hebron. Then Joab, the commander-in-chief of David's army, returned from, we'll say, a foray into some enemy land with great spoil, and hears that Abner has been sent away. Now, Abner is his mortal enemy. He had been responsible for slaying the brother of Job, and Job intended, really, I'm sure, to do him in at whatever point he could in the future, and this would have been a very good opportunity for him. So he goes into David and he says, "You sent him away?" I mean, it was like Job questioning the king. Now, it's almost like, who's leading, David or Job? And Job, by the way, is a relative. Zeruiah is the sister of Joab, is the mother of Joab, David's sister. And, of course, there were three sons of Zeruiah, Joab, Abishai, and Asahel. Asahel had been the one whom Abner had slain with the butt end of his spear as Asahel was pursuing Abner. And so in order to really to get back at Abner for what he had done to his brother, Joab needed to have him and put him to death. So what does Joab do? He sends an embassy after Abner and indicates to him that we have some secrets to inform each other of, and I want to give you a secret. Well, that's when it says, ran him through under the fifth rib and he died. Then David doesn't want to be held guilty for it, so he mourns for Abner. Realize that Abner was really sort of a noble man, and that he really could perhaps have been put to use, but that he should not have been put to death under these circumstances. And anyway, he mourns for him. He won't eat. As a matter of fact, he said, "I will not partake of food until the setting of the sun," because of the fact that he wanted to demonstrate to the people. I mean, you would realize that the Israelites, those tribes that had not yet joined him officially, would be put out about the fact that Abner, who was, as I said, their de facto leader, was now murdered, really, as far as they were concerned. That was a horrendous act. And, of course, then David laments this whole thing at the end, and he says, "These sons of Zeruiah, Joab, Abishai, Asahel, they're very hard men." In other words, they're going to have to be held in control. They act on their own. They aren't as easily governed as they ought to be. And I think one of the reasons for that is the fact that they are relatives of David. So David is going to have a hard time with them, and we'll have to realize that they'll need to be watched constantly to be sure they don't act on their own. That's the end of the chapter. Well, then the next chapter, this is a very important chapter because it leads into what finally happens in chapter 5, where some interesting things are said. Some New Testament events are, in a sense, forecast there. But here we have now Ishbosheth and Israel, very much concerned. That very first verse says that. Ishbosheth, of course, is very terrified by what happened. And the people, Israel thinks, what's going to happen to us? Our real leader, Abner, is dead. And now what? Who's going to be the leader over us? What will David do? Will he attack en masse and just destroy us? They were unsure of David. They really didn't know of David's character, of how, the kind of integrity that he possessed. But at this point, they didn't know. And they realized that David now is, quotes, officially the leader, but yet not actually over Israel. So they're worried. All right, so now there are these two men who are mentioned, Rechab and Baanah. They're corporals, maybe sergeants, who have been placed over groups. They would lead, again, these forays out to enemy territory and capture or destroy enemy troops and then return. They were that kind of soldiers under Abner. All right, it just tells us about them here and what they are. And then it's interesting, there is this little, what shall we call, a little event that is described for us here, which will become important later on, about a son of Jonathan, Mephibosheth. When they hear, the nurse and Mephibosheth, when they hear about the death of Saul and Jonathan, his sons, in that last battle with the Philistines, they run. They need to leave the city, and in doing so, there is an accident. Now, I'm not real sure how your translation puts it, but the King James says simply that the son, Mephibosheth, which means, by the way, exterminator of shame, whatever that involves, idols, images maybe, why he was called that, I'm not sure. But at this point, he's 5 years old. In the King James, it just simply says he fell and injured himself to the point that he was lame. I don't know what yours says, but some of the translations say the nurse held him. It says she picked him up. Nasa is the Hebrew word there, so that she picked him up. Now, how to envision that, I'm not real sure. He did fall. My guess is that they were running away, that they came maybe to some place where there's a small cliff or something like that, rocks, and that he stumbled and fell and injured himself seriously because he was permanently lame at that point. But one of the translations, not only one, a number of the translations that I looked at said she picked him up and dropped him. And so in my own mind, I questioned, he's 5 years old. Yeah. Now, unless he were sickly, which is not impossible, otherwise you just expect that it's, as I think the King James says, he fell.
Yeah, that's
and injured himself.
Same in the ESV, it's his nurse took him up and fled, and as she fled in her haste, he fell and became lame.
Yeah, see, it attributes the haste to her, but obviously he's following her. But as a five-year-old.
Yeah, right.
And there we go. We were speculating about when we were going to hear the carpenters next door, and we just have. I hope that
maybe that'll be it.
Our audience remembers whenever they hear this to realize we're not expiring here at this point, at least.
That's right.
But that it's noise that these carpenters are making while they repair or really renew some a room next door to us. Anyway, so he fell. And he's lame. All right? That's just sort of the end of the story. Well, it isn't, because later on we're going to come across him again as Jonathan's son. But it's important to remember him as Jonathan's son. That David's relationship with Jonathan will be seen in what happens to him, but at a later time. Anyway, then it says about this Rechab and Baana, the sergeants, I guess we'll call them, in the army, and under Abner, who was to some degree a ruthless man himself. Of course, you have to be if you're going to be the captain of an army. Anyway, they, it says, stole into Ish-bosheth, the king's, I guess, palace. He was taking his noonday siesta. He was sleeping. And they decapitated him. They took his head with them to David. Now, you have to understand probably what was going through their minds. Initially, when we described them, I didn't say that they were from the tribe of Benjamin, Saul's tribe. We're no longer relevant, they must have said to themselves. How can we ingratiate ourselves with David, the new king? So they had this idea. His enemy, of course, is Ish-bosheth, you know. If we give him Ish-bosheth's head, rather than taking a picture of his corpse, this is the way they would have to do it in those days. You want to be sure it's Ish-bosheth? Here's his head. So you'll know it's him. Anyway, they took the head with them. They came to David with it. They called Ish-bosheth the enemy, and Saul his enemy in particular, who was pursuing him. They knew of what was going on there. And so they expected that somehow they would be rewarded by David, not knowing really what kind of man David was, what kind of character he had. Well, you can imagine David when they brought the head of this, quotes, king, Ish-bosheth. And then he recalled the event of the Amalekite who came to him in chapter 1. We talked a little bit about that guy who came to David with the news that Saul was dead and Jonathan was dead, expecting a reward, it says here. Only to be done in immediately by the young men who accompanied David, his soldiers, who would carry out his command. Same thing here. He says to these two, this man came to me with the news, just the news. It doesn't even say that David believed what he said about his activity in that whole event with Saul Saul leaning on his sword, supposedly his spear, this man had said. Anyway, he doesn't even say that here. He just says he's expecting a reward for bringing me this news. I don't know. How does your translation put that?
How much more than... Behold, Saul is dead, and he thought he was bringing good news. I seized him and killed him at Ziklag, which was a reward I gave him for his news.
Yeah, that's a reward he got for the news.
Yeah.
But it doesn't say that he had in any way participated in the death.
Yeah.
Now, perhaps he did, perhaps he didn't, perhaps that was a story. Whatever it was, the news was not the kind that David wanted to hear, and that was the end of him. So he expected a reward. What do you think will happen? I'm sure asking these two guys. It's a rhetorical question. I don't think he expects an answer. What do you think should happen, if I were saying, what do you think should happen to two men who slew a righteous man? I mean, Ish-bosheth hadn't done anything. He wasn't really an enemy, and I don't think could count on him to oppose David in any spectacular way. What do you suppose would happen? Well, David just says to the young men near him, take him and do away with him. And, of course, that's what happened to those two. And so that sort of brings us to the conclusion then.
And that's probably a good time to...
Yeah, he took the head, by the way. Just he took the head that they had brought to him and buried it in a tomb of Abner. Is that in the last verse there?
It is. The last verse mentions the tomb of Abner, but the same verse, but earlier in that verse, they killed him and cut off their hands and feet and hanged them beside the pool at Hebron.
Ah, yes.
They took the head of Ish-bosheth and buried it in the tomb of Abner.
Yeah, of course, I give it kind of a guess. I don't know what kind of burial that is. An honorable burial? I don't know the significance of the other either, taking the hands and feet and hanging them there over that pool. Mm. It certainly would be a warning. In other words, if people ask about that, it would be a warning about what David did and why. That David wasn't responsible for the death of that king, because there's a lot of treachery going on, and you just don't know who's on your side and who isn't, and he wants the people to realize, I think, don't take for granted that you can just slay people, murder them, and get away with it because they seem to be enemies of David. You better be absolutely sure of what you do, or else this, what you see here hanging over that pool in Hebron, that might happen. So it would be somewhat of a warning. But that does take us to the end now.
Right, and that's probably a good place to take a break, and we'll pick it up with Chapter 5 on the other side.
We'll be back in just a moment to the Concordia Bible Institute podcast. In the meantime, I'd like to have you consider this question. What is most important in higher education? How do you prioritize all the knowledge to be gained at an institution of higher learning? Concordia University, Wisconsin, located on the shores of Lake Michigan in Mequon, Wisconsin, just north of Milwaukee, is an institution that is committed to excellence in learning, but at the same time realizes that excellence in itself is insufficient without development in vocation. We believe that God works through our vocations, our callings, in order to serve the needs of those around us. The mission statement of Concordia University puts it this way: Concordia University, Wisconsin is a Lutheran higher education community committed to helping students develop in mind, body, and spirit for service to Christ in the church and the world. You can learn more about the over 70 programs offered at Concordia by visiting the website www.cuw.edu. And if you're benefiting from our Christ in Every Word podcast, I encourage you to support this ministry by mentioning it to others and by offering your monetary support. Please consider supporting the Concordia Bible Institute by going to our website, www.concordiabible.org, and clicking on the contribute page. And now, back to the podcast.
Alrighty there, folks. We are back with our study of 2 Samuel, and I was just discussing with Dr. Sleska in the break that the study note here in the ESV says that the hanging took place to show that they had died under the divine curse, and it references Deuteronomy 21, which is the cursed is everyone who is hanged upon a tree. Yeah.
That would, of course, imply that David knows the scriptures, or I assume if he did that, he recognizes, because all his psalms make reference to events in the scriptures. So he must have had access to the scriptures. Now, again, we just don't know how that would occur. I guess the book was there, but not everyone had equal access to it. Surely David probably did, but the psalmist, you know, as a psalmist, David knew, and he would make references to mm-hmm. those acts in history and those events in Israel's history from the past, from the Torah.
I'm reminded of Deuteronomy 17 with the king being commanded to, hey, you're going to need to read this a lot.
Right.
If you want to be a king, a righteous king.
Right.
Know the Torah.
It's easy for us to say, well, we've got access all over the place, I think, more so than in any at any time, which is interesting, any time in the history of the universe, there has been this kind of access online.
On the internet.
Everywhere. The scriptures are available. And just bits and pieces. If you can think of a part of a verse, but you don't know exactly where it is, type it in. You'll find it. They'll find it for you. Yeah, Google will Google it. And I do that occasionally. I think this verse is somewhere. And they find it. I mean, it's there. The whole Bible must be in there somehow.
It's a fascinating thing to think about how you have the availabilities there in the information age, but yet the illiteracy and the illiteracy
of the Bible,
of the Bible is still...
It's worse than ever.
Maybe worse than ever, even though our access, the accessibility, might be even the best it's ever been.
You know, that people often ask in the event of a tragic circumstances that occur... like 9/11 or something like that. Where was God in all of this? You know, the unbelievers ask that question.
Right.
And people often respond by saying, well, where was he? You've taken him out of everywhere, the schools. You've really done away with him. And there is that active kind of, what should we call it? I think hatred of God and anything that he stands for. You can't have crosses on symbols of towns like Los Angeles. There's a cross somewhere. I mean, the City of Angels. They can't change the name of the city, but they really seem to have taken the cross off that symbol for the city. And I knew that. I think I might have mentioned it once before that Frankenmuth, you know, Michigan, that they had a cross over this symbol, the city symbol, on a bridge, but there was a cross there, and an atheist in town insisted that it be taken off. And so that all the, almost immediately afterwards, because he was successful, the atheist was, in having that cross removed from the city symbol.
Wow.
Almost everyone in the city then, you could not drive through the city without seeing a cross on somebody's lawn. They simply retaliated by saying, okay, you don't want to see the cross? Then look around, you won't be able not to see it.
Right.
I don't know if that's a good idea, in your face sort of thing, but it did happen because I've been there a number of times. And most of them are gone now, but they weren't at the time, just everywhere. And you thought, well, that atheist, I think someone said he moved. I mean, just got to be, maybe he thought so hateful. I don't know that it was done in hate. I think it was simply done to show you, look, this is what we are.
Yeah. Right.
And if you go back in the history of this country, you see the same thing. And there's an attempt on the part of, and here Madison is the center of this whole thing about doing away with Jesus, you know. Get God out of everything. What is that? There's an agency there that sues cities all over the country. And it's centered in Madison. But anyway, that's a little bit off the point. But chapter 5.
David is anointed king.
Yes.
Again? A second
time?
We'll
see.
For the
Yes, he is. But now look at those first verses. And we need to spend a moment on those first verses because, okay, so we're starting a new era of David here. And the people of Israel come to him. And look, what do they say? We're bone of your bone and flesh of your flesh. We're bone of your bone, flesh of your flesh. So I'll remind you of Ephesians 5. We are members of his body, of his flesh, of his bones. Paul talking about marriage in that Ephesians 5. Well, Because we are talking about Christ there, though, then, about Christ, even as Christ loved the church and gave himself for it, that he might sanctify and cleanse it with the washing of water by the word, present it to himself a glorious church, not having spot or wrinkle or any such thing. So ought husbands to love their wives, even as their own bodies, etc. But then we are members of his body, of his flesh and of his bones. It makes that direct connection. And you know how this is how Matthew starts out. And by the way, I challenge, if you have a concordance, I want to challenge our listeners to go to your concordance and look up the word David in the Old Testament. Don't look through because you won't find them all. There must be 1,000 references to David in the Old Testament.
Got to be, yeah.
At least 100, maybe more, in the New Testament, not only in the Gospels, in the Epistles. In other words, he's front center. And Matthew starts out, the book of the generation of Jesus Christ, son of David, son of Abraham. I mean, right there, he's the son of David. It's that direct connection between Christ and David. It's why we're spending as much time as we are on the life of David, because he is so central to an understanding of what's happening in the New Testament. And then, of course, son of David. How often is that said? Son of David, have mercy on me. I mean, he has that appellation, that kind of name in the New Testament, son of David. So that the Jewish people would have, you can understand how that would anger them. He's not. And yet everybody attests to the fact that he is the son of David. So at Christmas, it's that sort of idea that here he's going to, he will become one of us, Luther says. He will be like us, taking on human form, God. He will be like us. And then Luther asks, but who will be like him? That's a good question. Who will be like him? Which is, of course, what we all desire to be as we pray, that we could become more little Christs in this world. But who will be like him? And so, good question. Yeah, it's interesting, too. I think it was Luther, but someone, some illustrious theologian has said, God is like the sun. You can't look at it, but you can't see without it. Or this one by Luther also, while we're on this kind of thing, that the scriptures are the cradle that rocked the infant Christ. So you think of the scriptures that way, that they're the cradle that rocks the infant Christ. So we know what we're doing when we study the scriptures. And these statements here are not unimportant to an understanding of who David was, not only in the Old Testament, but especially in the New Testament, so that they understand the Old Testament as being fulfilled in the New Testament. Not unimportant, obviously. So it does verify that God made a promise and that he fulfilled that promise when our Lord himself came. If you can read those first statements and you get the idea, okay, he's gradually taking to himself the whole of Israel. In other words, Israel will now be marshaled behind this king. And, of course, he will be the one who leads them. And now read verses 2 and 3. In the King James, it's fascinating. I wonder how your translation will put it, verses 2 and 3, because it's, again, it calls him a captain. But one of the translations says shepherd, and bring us out and take us out and bring us in.
Well, in the ESV it says, in times past when Saul was king over us, it was you who led out and brought in Israel. And the Lord said to you, you shall be shepherd of my people Israel, and you shall be prince over Israel.
Now, put that in the context of John 10, the good shepherd. I'm the door, you know. They'll enter in and out. And you think, this is just practically saying the same thing about David in the Old Testament. So you can't help but understand this to be a prediction of the events in the New Testament, and John 10 in particular at that point. It just throws itself at you, and it's just so enlightening when you realize the importance of David, Old or New Testament, in as a shadow of the coming Messiah promised by God way back in Genesis 3. All right, now then, go ahead. He's going to establish himself here, and he's going to establish Jerusalem as his capital city. In verse 5, I think it is, verse 5 and 6, where he talks about he's ruled for, he was 40 years old when he began to rule, and then he ruled for these 33 years over both Israel and Judah.
Well, actually,
and the 7.5 over Judah.
Well, when it says here in verse 4 that he was 30 years old when he began to reign, and then he reigned 40
years.
Oh,
I'm sorry. Did I say 40?
Yeah.
Oh, I'm sorry, 30.
But the main reason I bring that up, though, is because that's the same thing that Luke says about Jesus. He was about 30 years old when
he was about
30.
See, you're getting those arms mixed up. Yes, that is interesting.
He was about 30 years old.
Yeah, about 30 years old.
And you wonder, the reader of the time, of Luke hearing 30 when he began to reign, hey, there was another guy who reigned when he was about 30.
Yeah, good thinking. I just kind of think that is all. I mean, there's so much in this, just little these first five verses.
Right.
But then David's going to go to Jerusalem, okay? He was going to make Jerusalem his capital city. And of course, this is interesting how the Jebusites occupied Jerusalem. Now, they're just one of those Canaanite tribes. I don't know too much about their background, but they were there. They probably, I don't know, in my study of the Old Testament, I think I read that somewhere Shem was one of the founders of Jerusalem. We have him mentioned, Melchizedek, king of Salem.
Salem, yeah.
So it goes way back, but that Shem was one of the founders, and so it belonged all the way back to the land that was given, to Abraham. Walk across it, and I'm going to give you that land which you walk across. So this is a kind of a fulfillment of the fact that this is going to be the capital city, and then it will be all the way into the New Testament. But it's going to start here really with David, who now is going to go in. He intends to go in, but the Jebusites who live there say, not so fast. You can take away, now I don't know what it says in your translation, take away the blind and the lame. Okay, that's supposedly a challenge. We could defeat, our blind and lame could defeat you.
Right.
You couldn't get in. I don't know what. How does yours put it?
You will not come in here, but the blind and the lame will ward you off.
Okay. In other words, we could defeat you with our blind and our lame. You're
right.
Just not getting in.
Right. Blindfolded, we could take.
Yeah, we could take you. with one hand tied behind us.
Right.
Not a problem. Now, this verse 8 is interesting. So, okay, David's got to go up, and he's going to take the city, and there is this challenge, and then it says something about a canal. I don't know, a river
watershed
like. That they went up through, that somehow the soldiers of David went up through, surprised, I'm sure, the Jebusites, and drove them out. It seems like it wasn't much of a battle at all, and that David could have done so with blind and lame, rather than the Jebusites hold him off with the blind and the lame. But he seems to have taken it casually almost. It's his. He's there. And it says he dwelled in the fort. What does yours say? Does it use the word fort?
Lived in the stronghold.
All right, that's it.
Stronghold,
stronghold. And the stronghold. But he built out from Millo. Now, I don't know. That's a mound, evidently, in Jerusalem. And he built out from there. So the city really is prospering, really is being built, and I'm sure is gathering fame. And of course, David is responsible for all of that. David's getting himself a name. That particular phrase will come a little later on when he wins an important battle. We'll refer to it again then. But already he is establishing himself as a very important figure. And he's now being made king over over all Israel and Judah, anointed king. And of course, not without... I don't know if there were any, but I don't know of any that attempted at least some sort of rebellion against him. The people of Judah accepted him, I think, at face value. He was one of theirs. But the children of Israel, having said, "You're of our bone and flesh," they seem to have accepted him pretty readily as he began to establish himself. But then it says The Philistines attack. So he's made king. The Philistines attack. And David, now interestingly here, David inquires of the Lord, shall I go up against them? Will you deliver them into my hand, is the way he puts it in the King James. And the Lord said, go up. You'll be victorious. I'll deliver them up to you. So he does, and God does. Delivers them up. He defeats them. Okay? They attack again. I think it says that they marshal themselves in the valley of Rephidim.
Rephaim?
Yeah,
Rephaim, I think, is what I have.
Oh, Rephidim. Well, that's what it says. The King James spells it that way. But anyway, there in that valley. And so then, interestingly, the Lord says to him, in this instance when he inquires, don't go up. Hmm. But it says an interesting way of saying it in the King James, fetch a compass.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
It says go around their rear.
The rear end, yeah. In other words, attack from the rear, but fetch a compass, whatever that means, I guess. Anyway, that's an expression from the King James. Go behind them, and then, this, I think it's the second last verse in the chapter, then it says, wait, I don't know what yours says. King James says, wait for a movement in the mulberry trees. Yours won't use mulberry, probably, but...
Balsam trees. When you hear the sound of marching in the tops of the balsam trees.
Yeah, but marching.
Marching, yeah.
Movement, it says in the King James. Motion, movement. I don't know what that means.
Huh.
But I suppose...
the study note says, heavenly hosts on the move.
Yeah. Oh, does it?
Ah. What do you think? Ah. Heavenly hosts on the move.
How does your translation put it, though, in the...
When you hear the sound of the marching...
Marching?
...in the tops of the balsam trees, then rouse yourself, for then the Lord has gone out before you to strike down the enemy.
It's got
to
be the heavenly host of some sort. You know...
And just the difference
The army of God. The armies of God.
Right, right.
In well, the Lord of the hosts, trees. You know?
Yeah.
That's got to be what it means. It's interesting how the King James... Movement, it says in the King James. That's the word... I looked that word up. It means that, just movement. Obviously, it has quite a number of meanings, but that's why I guess the King James uses that word. But nevertheless, okay. But I like your idea much better because you can think of angels, you can think of the heavenly host, and you can say, hey, this battle is over, and you don't know it. You know, remember when Elisha says...
Yeah, I was just thinking that, the
says,
Elisha.
Well,
yeah.
The Lord let him see. Whoa!
Oh, okay.
not to worry.
Yeah.
Those that are with us are more than those that are with them.
Right.
Oh, yeah, I don't see anybody. Well, they're there. And we don't see it either, but they're there.
That's right. That's right.
Well, anyway,
right.
Are but, we... How far...
Yeah. Oh, that's
we shouldn't go to the next chapter.
No. But that's a good work for today, Dr. S. You made it through two chapters.
Two.
That doesn't happen very
often
around here.
That could be monumental. Have we ever?
I don't know.
Well, it's Christmas.
It is Christmas, so that was a bit of a Christmas present, maybe.
Okay.
So. Well, thanks again, Dr. Seleska, for that Christ-centered reflection on these chapters of 2 Samuel. Please consider mentioning this podcast to your family and friends so that they too can learn more about God's Word with us. The mission of the Concordia Bible Institute is to provide Christ-centered Bible instruction from distinguished experts who teach Christ in every word of the Old and New Testaments to strengthen faith and spread belief in the one true God. If you benefit from this podcast series, I encourage you to consider supporting the Bible Institute by going to our website, www.concordiabible.org, and clicking on our contribute page. Until next time, I'm Dr. Brian Gurman, here today with Dr. John Seleska, wishing you God's blessings in Christ Jesus our Lord.